Okay, thanks very much. Thank you, Salim, for your presentation, because I want to also just connect. By connecting, I want to just preface my presentation with a few points. One is that Muslim societies are not homogenous. Nowhere are they, and whoever claims so, I think, as basically, and even in Islamic State, there's no such thing as Islamic State that exists. It might be an ideal thing, but that is something that very far-fetched. Not necessarily a pipe dream, but far-fetched. And that is based upon a number of issues. One, because as we have just mentioned a moment ago, because Muslim societies are homogenous, you also therefore find many representatives or voices that argue that they are representative of the Muslim community. And this is where the focus of my paper is going to be on the Darul Ulooms, that is the Muslim theological institutions or theological seminaries rather, seems to argue along the lines that they are representative voices of the Muslim society, particularly from the theological stroke juridical perspective. In other words, they seem to represent Muslim voice as the bona fide interpreters and represent the gatekeepers, so to speak, of the sacred texts. But we'll sort of just come into that. I just want to also just make two other points. One is that when we heard Professor Peter Hudson basically make reference to the point that whatever happens normally within the sort of these religious communities, inevitably they land up in court. And so in a sense it's that sort of interconnectedness that sort of remains there, and something that perhaps it would be great to research further, just to see that and why that happens. Because on one hand you find, particularly in Muslim societies, you find that normally whenever something goes to court, it is pertaining to some internal Muslim legal matter, whether it's divorce, whether it's marriage, whether it's death, whatever the case may be, basic inheritance, and that is. And then connected to that, the other co-organizer of the conference, Professor Cole, basically raised the issue when, in his presentation. What is interesting, and this is where I want to sort of locate my paper. When you look at the map that he sort of shared with us from the Pew research project, Southern Africa has a situation where the issue of religious freedom is widespread. You move from Botswana to Zambia to Zimbabwe to South Africa. I mean, we basically have a situation where this is not seen elsewhere. And this is sort of something great and very positive. On that positive note, let me sort of then come to my paper. I sort of look at sort of two dimensions, so to speak. One is to look at Darul Ulooms, the Muslim theological seminaries as such, and their role. And then more specifically trying to look at in which way are they what we call Sharia agents, of course not maybe in a CIA sense, but more in terms of how they fundamental role they play on behalf of Muslim communities that they represent. But also, bearing in mind, and which I did not perhaps clarify in my presentation here, but just to say as a footnote, is that there are also power struggles amongst them. In other words, the one institution wants to demonstrate its power by perhaps offering a better program as opposed to another. Not necessarily complementary. They are complementary, but they do also operate as power blocks. And that is something to remember. So that means the state has a problem. If there are agents that represent these communities, on the other hand, the state has to deal with it. Now, in my paper itself, I introduced my paper by talking about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Here in South Africa, the former deputy president, Khalim Motlanthe, and our Minister of Home Affairs, Malere Pando, had inducted 100 imams in as marriage officers. And that was a very interesting development. Well, I suppose some said politically motivated. I mean, of course, we're not going to question that. But the interesting part of this is that Muslim personal law has been on the agenda in South Africa for the past more than 20 years, from during the apartheid state into the democratic state. But up to now has not been resolved. Why? Because of the various players, such as the Darul Ulooms. And so we will come to that story as such. Now, these Darul Ulooms are seen as what we call Muslim seminaries or theological seminaries of higher learning or higher education. In other words, they see themselves as post-school institutions, and where they basically train individuals in Sharia, in Islamic law. The word Islamic law, by the way, is also problematic for me. Just a quick footnote. I would rather call it Muslim law than Islamic law. Partly because, of course, these are English terms, but the point of the matter is that when you talk about Islamic, as if the law is so Islamic that you can't sort of change it. But, as you will find, there is room for interpretation all the time. The mere fact that you have various branches within the Muslim society, you have the Shafi'i school as opposed to the Hanafi school, as opposed to the Maliki school. The Maliki school had an operative in the Lawal case. That is why they argued along the way they did. But forgetting there are other schools of interpretation too. And that in itself sort of opened the way for sort of power struggle, so to speak, legally, intellectually, and otherwise. But I mean, again, but then of course, also, as you know, we have the Shia school. And there's another smaller school, the Ibadis, the Kharijites, which of course not much has been spoken about at the moment. But we go to Oman, we go to East Africa, there are pockets of these. But the point which I want to highlight more is that Sharia itself as a system has been appropriated very soon. Of course, there are the non-negotiables, where you don't seek, basically don't, there's nothing to negotiate about. But even in those, in other words, you must pray 5 times a day. So there's no argument about that. But the issue here is that there are also interpretations. Because in Shia, you can pray 5 times a day, sort of 3 times, but you basically combine 2 of them. 2 sort of in the afternoon, 2 in the evening, and so you still fulfill the 5, but just legally different. So in other words, what we're saying here is that there are various ways of negotiating even those non-negotiables. But it's the way it has been appropriated. So having said that, let me just quickly come, because since this is sort of part of the subtitle of Sharia agents, so what is Sharia then? So Sharia refers to the body of law defined by God's word as captured in the primary source, namely the Quran. Because for Muslims, Quran is the source. You don't even, in other words, it's not such as the biblical hermeneutics, where you can talk about Quranic hermeneutics in a similar sense, because that is untouchable, therefore you interpret only within the understanding of the way God has revealed. So there is this sort of course, as you know, that within Muslim society, there have been the progressive Muslims who have basically come on board and have been engaging on that issue. The second point, it's a mean, basically Sharia means way or path. Of course, again, we're not going to go into the other aspect, but I mean, this is more or less. And it has been described as a code of conduct for Muslims. And some add, of course, non-Muslims too, just within the broad parameters. But however, this Quran, this source, this primary source, is not the only source. It has also been complemented by the words of the Prophet, or not only the words, but the deeds which are captured in the term Sunnah. But in addition, there are the set of secondary sources that also come into play. And this is exactly areas of contestation, because who basically is qualified to apply his or her mind? And I say her mind because there are of late, by the way, no more just male figures in the Sharia block who have been trained, they are also females. The question is, how are the voices, like the last person who asked in the previous session, the issue of gender? Fortunately, they are up and coming, but still, their spaces are still limited, restricted. So in a sense, what we have here, just to give us an overview of the Quran, the Sunnah, and then there are these other dimensions, what are known as second sources. But this has been, by the way, is set by a scholar by the name of Ash-Shafi in the early centuries, and he was counted by others in terms of these secondary sources. And I think what I'm just trying to say here is that, of course, it was somewhat formalized in this way, structured in this way. So in this way, it guided subsequent communities as to how they can go about interpreting the primary source, as well as the other second of the two primary sources, that is the Sunnah, that is the statements and deeds of the Prophet, and at the same time apply their mind. In other words, what extent can they come together, club together, in other words, have consensus amongst themselves on a particular issue, whether it's inheritance, whether it's marriage, whether it's whatever the case may be, and in this one. And of course, the one at the bottom, Qiyas, what they call analogical reasoning, it sometimes can be applied by individual jurists, Muslim jurists. In other words, if they, for example, just to give you a, sort of an example of the issue of the Arab plan, for example, in that, which took place here in South Africa by Kasbana in the 60s, I mean, it was a major issue. Then there were fatwas, legal opinions that were given. Individuals said, well, you can. But then they said, but you're going to basically put a pig, a valve of a pig in the heart of a human being, can you? Because after a pig, you can't consume. But then, of course, the Malaysia argument made, well, you are not going to eat the pig's valve, you're going to eat the plant. So, I mean, these are, of course, I'm just sort of adding a little juicy pastor. But I mean, these are some of the issues that normally came up. Of course, in the end, they accepted the idea of Arab plant. But that was one issue. The issue of the microphone, which we are using now, in the 1920s, the Saudi jurists were arguing whether they should really use a microphone because their voice, it is not their natural voice. It's being carried by another instrument that is carrying it. So when they call for prayer, they must do it, you know, sort of on their own and without a mic. So, of course, later this was all set aside. But I mean, these are sort of developments. I'm going to sort of skip, but I just want to come to the second part, or rather two last bullets. They talk about the issue of maslaha, or benefits, interest, and of custom. And these are two words, or somewhat intertwined, connected words, but more specifically, the very ultimate one, that has been used by current jurists in the sense of when we talk about the issue of the common good. In other words, how do you apply, of course, this is the sub-focus of this legal conference, how do you appropriate the law, the Muslim legal system, as a way of creating a common good that all, not only Muslims, because Muslims are those who submit to God, but also those who do not submit to God in a similar fashion. So how do you accommodate those individuals, those communities, those societies? And this, of course, is the challenge. So I think this is sort of just a part of that presentation. But let me give you a large context in which the Darul Uloom and the Muslim theological seminaries sort of emerged. Just a quick glance, early statistics give us the idea that when you look at Southern Africa, for Southern Africa, by the way, also problematic in terms of where you sort of draw the line of what is Southern Africa, what is not. This is based on the SADC, Southern African Development Community, in which the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United Republic of Tanzania have also been included in the SADC. But of course, we can lower the line and maybe just include up to Zambia, perhaps, or whatever. But be that as it is. Statistically, or demographically, you can see the Muslim population is pretty small. Of course, it's early statistics, but more than 10 years ago. But they still apply because, I mean, the numbers have not really sort of increased dramatically. So that's all. And so when you look at the statistics overall, of course, Tanzania has the largest Muslim population. But, of course, we haven't included South Africa here. But South Africa, according to even the most recent statistics, remain somewhat hovering in 2%, 2.5%. Of course, that remains a debatable issue. And how do you basically calculate, how do you basically come to that figure? But be that as it may, that is how it's out, 50 million. Now, giving us sort of that particular background, when we talk about the Sharia agency, of course, something in terms that has to be defined, Sharia being the Muslim system, of course, this institution acting as agents. The idea of is somewhat, that one is not totally correct as I'm putting it here, but it's somewhat an all-embracing phenomenon somewhat in the sense that these agents, these individuals or bodies or institutions, they act as locales of social change. And so as locales of social change, which means positive change, not necessarily negative, of course when we look at Boko Haram as an example, I mean, that is totally the opposite. In fact, they act in contradiction to their principles on which they base themselves. I mean, you can't basically act violently and say you are Muslim. Contradiction. I mean, they have these dimensions, dynamics. So these institutions, they focus on theological and jurisprudential aspects, and they reflect upon the role that as agents of positive change, they do so within the social, legal, theological arena. And so they, in a sense, act as Muslims' bona fide representatives. This is how they see themselves. Now that if you go to any of these Muslim theological seminaries, they would argue along those lines. And even the basic graduate, you will see, in most cases, a he, of course, there are she's also now, they will see themselves as the spokesperson. If you're not trained in Muslim law, then automatically you're not really a Balunafide speaker, because you can't talk about the Quran, you can't talk about the Sunnah. In other words, there must be these individuals who are trained. So, talking then about the sort of agents of change, the social change, it is argued that education through such as the Ulums, now of course, by the way, these Ulums have their roots in South Asia, not in the Middle East, not in the Muslim heartlands as such, in South Asia, interesting. There was this institution known as Deoband that was established in 1866, which basically, of course, bearing in mind the Muslims in South Asia were and still are a minority, but they tried to assert their identity as such. And this institution was seen as a vehicle of asserting that. So the issue of identity formation also becomes an important sort of issue. And so this model ultimately finds itself migrating elsewhere, and it came to Southern Africa. First to South Africa, and then it spread across to Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Botswana now of late, then you have Zambia. So you find, you know, in each of these countries, there are replicas of this particular model. And so, because of this, they basically, of course, bear in mind that they operate in the arena, or the process that will work, the secularization, modernization, globalization. So they operate within that frame. But at the same time, they are there, as we have said a moment ago, they are institutions or vehicle of identity construction. In other words, they want to reaffirm identity as being Muslims within a larger sort of non-Muslim environment. And so, because they see themselves, they connect, for example, South Asian, particularly Indians, they connect themselves with their motherland, India. But at the same time, being Muslim, they want to connect themselves. The only way to do so is to be exposed to Muslim education that helps to perpetuate that, to reinforce that idea. And so, but interestingly also, since we comes with the baggage. And that baggage, of course, culture, as we know, has also become a problematic concept in relation to religion. And sometimes it has been merged with the notion as if, say, the way the women wear in Afghanistan is a Muslim practice or something. Yes, it's a cultural practice, but not necessarily Muslim, because you can't see the face. Because the Quran verse itself, you can view the face of the woman. So the point of the matter, I think, is interpretations. And this is traditional culture. And of course, diasporic communities, like we have in South Africa, in Botswana, and so forth, have basically emerged. And so because of this, again, I'm going to skip the bit basically to make the point or to raise the sort of question. Do these institutions, just the last bullet on the left, cultivate good citizenship? Do they really work towards the common good of society? In which way do they? Because if they are only teaching Muslim theology and Muslim jurisprudence or the legal system, what extent do they, in one way or the other, try to emphasize, as Sharia agents, emphasize the common good? In other words, do they really say to their students, well, when you get out of this institution, graduate, you must be a good citizen? And from our sort of superficial study, by the way, put it that way, there's nothing that comes out like that. Although some of the texts that they do prescribe do talk about some of these issues, but the question is, to what extent do they realistically engage with the notion within the largely non-Muslim society? The constitution basically guarantees us religious freedoms, but to what extent do they engage with that? Now, of course, what was interesting, just as a side note too, when the gays and lesbians were given the right to marry according to the constitution, there were, of course, grumblings by religious communities against that. But at the same time, this constitution has guaranteed them their freedom, just to allow them to raise their voices, but at the same time to tolerate and respect the others. Whether they accept those gay and lesbian marriages, that's something else. And just as another footnote upon footnote, there have been, of course, Muslim gay individuals who have emerged, or lesbian individuals, who have argued for their own right to express their views on religion as bona fide South African citizens. So there are these dynamics that operate. So, okay, let me just... So the problems then that we have in nation state is, as we said, the question of religious freedom, which of course is focal. The issue of Muslim, of course, I've just sort of inserted the other points which I felt that was important. I mean, we talked about Muslim funds that emerge. How do these Muslim theological institutions operate? Where do they bank? Do they bank with Islamic banks in South Africa? No, they don't. They go to First National Bank, Standard Bank. All of the institutions operate on interest. Yet they would justify their rationale for operating. So in other words, come back to the issue of interpretation. Who interprets? Those very people who defend their interpretation of Muslim law or Sharia. Yet on the other hand, they will justify why they have to have a banking account with Standard Bank or whatever. So, I mean, these are the sort of dynamics. Interestingly, just as a side issue too, is South Asian migrants, sheikhs who normally come, speaking Urdu and Arabic, both not familiar with the local languages. There's also a clash of language, culture, whatever. I mean, those are parts of it. But let me quickly just, I think maybe just leave it more for discussion. We may come to some of the other rooms. Here, I mean, these are beautiful other rooms, don't you think? Yeah, of course. Where did the money come from? I mean, just a question I raised a moment ago. But, and they are flourishing. And just to give you an idea in terms of, of course, Islamic studies in Arabic, by the way, but I want to just come to the, I mean, this is more or less a picture, hopefully a representative one of the number of them, of course, very small, sorry, because I just tried to flag in as many of them inside. But what you can see, of course, these institutions flourish within the South African environment, using South African more sense, because there are those institutions in Zambia and Zimbabwe, as I mentioned earlier, but most of them are to be found in South Africa. The mere fact that they exist demonstrates to what extent our constitution has given that freedom of religion to exist, to operate, to flourish, and that is a plus, which sometimes they don't sometimes see. Particularly in the line of the fact that when they try to interpret Muslim law or Muslim person law specifically, they try to narrowly do it without looking at the larger picture. And this is part of the challenging problem that we sometimes face. Of course, we just gave names of governments in the neighborhood. As you can see, from Zambia to Mozambique, in fact, Mozambique, there are more or less four of them, not two, but I mean, these are sort of clear indicators as to what extent Muslim communities have managed to use institutions as a way of identity construction information. This is part of that. So the rationale then of these outlooks as a matter of information, or Muslim theological seminaries emerge, as they question the teaching of Islamic studies in universities. Saying, but these are secular institutions, why not to teach Islamic studies in this institution? Who's qualified to teach? The guy with a PhD from Chicago, and was it in a double room in India? So in other words, the question, because what happens here in the questioning process, there are threatened, underlined. In other words, there are new spokespersons. There are new individuals, kids on the block, coming in and challenging the rights of these interpreters. And this is where South Africa or Southern Africa becomes an interesting location where these debates are ongoing. Unfortunately, not written much about, but they are there. So what you find in America or in Western Europe has been ongoing here in different ways and on smaller levels, but I mean some. The issue of secular training graduates, as we have said, challenged to some degree the authority of theological leadership. And that is an issue that is still ongoing. And of course, not just the leadership, but interpretation. Because the fellow who basically only studied Arabic in South Africa, went to Saudi Arabia, or to Egypt, or to Syria, and just to brush up Arabic, wasn't trained, but read on, and of course, were tutored in these areas. But of course, they're not seen as bona fide speakers because they didn't come from a Muslim theological seminary that had been recognized within the traditional sect. And here I want to quickly just focus on, as I had said at the very onset, Muslim society is not homogenous. And so there are various interpretations. And what you find in the Sunni society, let's leave alone the Shia, because they also have internal differences. Of course, I know that some Muslim scholars don't want to talk about these differences, the sectarian ones. So let's leave out the word sectarian. But there are these schools, these strands of thinking that operate. And what is interesting is that these are ulum that operate, for example, on South African soil. They are also divided along the Deobandi line, which is one particular strand, which if you want to read more about it, go to Barbara Metcalf's very fascinating work long years ago, still very much important, in which she unravels and gives us, unpacks the Deobandi mindset and thinking. Of course, there are others now. And then there's the Bahrainis, who operate somewhat differently and interpret differently, though they might have commonalities, and this is something which... So there are these, and that is part of the reason why Muslim personal law could not be recognized by the state as yet. Not to say the state doesn't want to, the state would want to, but because of these internal power blocks, it is difficult for the state to decide. I mean, the state is trying to do their best, and I must say their best, because they're the ones who initiated it to form a grouping. But one group doesn't recognize Sheikh X or Imam Y or Banara Z, and as a result, it remains an X or rather a question. And it is because of these other players, apart from the Muslim theological seminaries that operate, there are these theological bodies that seem to impose their understanding, interpretation, and appropriation of the Islam, the way they understand upon society. Of course, many of you are familiar with the halal certification. South Africa has been one of the interesting places where halal certificate was given way back in 1986. One of the first stamps came onto, you know, onto the market. And this is part of the, with the power, the financial clout that Muslims started to demonstrate. They might be minority, but it's partly also to do with commercialization of the product, because the state realized, or the market industry realized, they can export to the Middle East, to the Gulf states. There's another market. So why not accept this idea? So they brought it on board. Of course, the Christian society did not realize this dimension. They only looked at it. But of course, on the one hand, the Muslim society, and more specifically these theological bodies, also realized it's a way of getting an revenue. Because for each certificate you sell, there's a certain income, which of course they don't share with the large community. So you have the MJC, the Muslim Research Council, operating in this region and in parts of other parts of Zara. So by the way, if you have a chance, for those of you who are familiar with Africa, just go to the, if you go to any supermarket now, just go and pick up a product and you see the stamp. You'll find a halal stamp. Where is the MJC stamp? And then there are other little smaller power brokers. The Islamic Council of South Africa, the NIHA, of course, and WUHA, and you can make a WUHA. But the point of that is that there are so many of these. But here again is to what extent these Darul Ulooms are able to eventually show their power, their theological, legal sort of influence coming to bear in these sects. So the halal issue is sort of one. So the question then of the common good has been, as we said, masaha. But we basically sort of just want to raise an interesting sort of work. Just to make the point is that when we go to a scholar by name of Abdel Nono, basically made the point that the common good is the overall condition of life in society that allows the different groups and their members to achieve their own perfection more fully and more easily. Now, looking at the theoretical frame, trying to also unpack this particular phrase, to what extent do the Muslim theological institution appropriate this idea and apply it in the way he has articulated? And to what, of course, to what extent, as we had said earlier, the word Muslim maslaha, of beneficial interest, is that sort of then applied. So, okay, I'm going to skip because of time. Come to the end. And just raise the question. To what extent then are these Muslim theological seminaries acting as Sharia's agents for the common good? I leave that question to you to further explore. Thank you.